and her trousers tangled around that ankle, ribs standing stark as she retched. A strip of light from the window cut over one shoulder blade, bright, bright, and found a big scar, a burn like a letter upside down. She rocked back, turned eyes sunken in dark rings on him, and wiped a string of spit from the corner of her mouth.
"Another kiss?"
The sound he made was indescribable, part laugh, part belch, part groan. He could not have made it again in a year of trying, but why would he have wanted to?
"Gotta get some air."
Shai dragged up her trousers, but left the belt dangling, and they sagged off her arse as she tottered to the window.
"Don't do it,"
moaned Temple, but there was no stopping her, not without moving, and that was inconceivable. She hauled the curtains away and pushed the window wide, while he struggled feebly to shield his eyes from the merciless light. Shai was cursing as she fished around under the other bed. He could hardly believe it when she came up with a quarter-full bottle, pulled the cork with her teeth, and sat there gathering her courage like a swimmer staring into an icy pool.
"You're not going to—"
She tipped the bottle up and swallowed, clapped the back of her hand to her mouth, stomach muscles fluttering, and burped, and grimaced, and shivered, and offered it to him.
"You?"
she asked, voice wet with rushback. He wanted to be sick just looking.
"God, no! It's the only thing'll help. Is the cure for a stab wound really another one? Once you set to stabbing yourself, it can be hard to stop."
She shrugged her shirt over that scar, and after doing a couple of buttons, realized she had them in the wrong holes and the whole front twisted, gave up and slumped down on the other bed. Temple wasn't sure he'd ever seen anyone look so worn out and defeated, not even in the mirror. He wondered whether he should put his clothes on. Some of the muddy rags scattered across the boards bore a faint resemblance to part of his new suit, but he could not be sure of anything. He forced himself to sit, dragging his legs off the bed as if they were made of lead. When he was sure his stomach would not immediately rebel, he looked at Shai and said,
"You'll find them, you know." "How do I know?" "Because no one deserves a good turn of the card more." "You don't know what I deserve."
She slumped back on her elbows, head sinking into her bony shoulders.
"You don't know what I've done. Can't be worse than what you did to me last night."
She didn't laugh. She was looking past him, eyes focused far away.
"When I was 17, I killed a boy."
Temple swallowed.
"Well, yes, that is worse. I ran off from the farm. Hated it there. Hated my bitch mother. Hated my bastard stepfather."
"Lamb?"
"No, the first one. My mother got through him. I had some fool notion I'd open a store. Things went wrong right off. Didn't mean to kill that boy, but I got scared and I cut him."
She rubbed absently under her jaw with a fingertip.
"He wouldn't stop bleeding."
"Did he have it coming?"
"Guess he must have. Got it, didn't he? But he had a family, and they chased me, and I ran, and I got hungry, so I started stealing."
She droned it all out in a dead monotone.
"After a while I got to thinking no one gives you a fair chance, and taking things is easier than making them. I fell in with some low company and dragged them lower. More robbing and more killings, and maybe some had it coming and maybe some didn't. Who gets what they deserve?"
Temple thought of Cardia.
"I'll admit God can be a bit of a shit that way. In the end, there were bills up over half the near country for my arrest. Smoke, they called me, like I was something to be scared of, and put a price on my head. About the only time in my life I was thought worth something."
She curled her lips back from her teeth.
They caught some woman and hanged her in my place. Didn't even look like me. But she got killed, and I got away with it, and I don't know why."
There was a heavy silence then. She raised the bottle and took a couple of good long swallows, neck working with the effort, and she came up gasping for air, with eyes watering hard. That was an excellent moment for Temple to mumble his excuses and run. A few months ago, the door would have been swinging already. His debts were settled, after all, which was better than he usually managed on his way out. But he found this time he did not want to leave. "If you want me to share your low opinion of yourself," he said, "I'm afraid I can't oblige. Sounds to me like you made some mistakes."
"You'd call all that mistakes?"
"Some pretty stupid ones, but yes, you never chose to do evil."
"Who chooses evil?"
"I did. Pass me that bottle."
"What's this?"
she asked as she tossed it across.
"A shitty past competition?"
"Yes, and I win." He closed his eyes and forced down a swallow, burning and choking all the way. "After my wife died, I spent a year as the most miserable drunk you ever saw."
"I've seen some pretty fucking miserable ones."
"Then picture worse. I thought I couldn't get any lower, so I signed up as lawyer for a mercenary company, and found I could." He raised the bottle in salute. "The Company of the Gracious Hand, under Captain General Nicomo Koska. Oh, noble brotherhood!" He drank again. It felt good, in a hideous way, like picking at a scab.
"Sounds fancy?"
"That's what I thought."
"Wasn't fancy."
"A worse accumulation of human scum you never saw."
"I've seen some pretty fucking bad ones."
"Then picture worse." "To begin with, I believed there were good reasons for what they did, what we did. Then I convinced myself there were good reasons. Then I knew there weren't even good excuses, but did it anyway because I was too coward not to. We were sent to the near country to root out rebels. A friend of mine tried to save some people. He was killed, and them. They killed each other. But I squirmed away, as always, and I ran, like the coward I am, and I fell in a river, and, for reasons best known only to himself, God sent a good woman to fish my worthless carcass out."
"As a point of fact, God sent a murdering outlaw."
"His ways are damned mysterious. I can't say I took to you right away, that's true, but I'm starting to think God sent exactly what I needed." Temple stood. It wasn't easy, but he managed it. "I feel like all my life I've been running. Maybe it's time for me to stick. To try it, at least." He sank down beside her, the creaking of the bedsprings going right through him.
"I don't care what you've done. I owe you. Only my life now, but still.
Let me stick." He tossed the empty bottle aside, took a deep breath, licked his finger and thumb tip, and smoothed down his beard. "God help me, but I'll take that kiss now." She squinted at him, every color in her face wrong, skin a little yellow, eyes a little pink, lips a little blue.
"You serious?"
"I may be a fool, but I'm not letting a woman who can fill a sick pot without spilling pass me by. Wipe your mouth and come here." He shifted towards her, someone clattering in the corridor outside, and her mouth twitched up in a smile. She leaned towards him, hair tickling his shoulder, and her breath smelled foul, and he did not care. The doorknob turned and rattled, and Shy bellowed at the door, so close and broken-voiced it felt like a hatchet blow in Temple's forehead.
"You got the wrong fucking room, idiot!"
Against all expectation, the door lurched open anyway, and a man stepped in. A tall man, with close-cropped fair hair and sharp clothes. He had a sharp expression, too, as his eyes wandered unhurried about the place, as if this was his room, and he was both annoyed and amused to find someone else had been fucking in it. "I think I got it right," he said, and two other men appeared in the doorway, and neither looked like men you'd be happy to see anywhere, let alone uninvited in your hotel room. "I heard you've been looking for me."
"Who the fuck are you?"
growled Shai, eyes flickering to the corner where her knife was lying sheathed on the floor. The newcomer smiled like a conjurer about to pull off the trick you won't believe. "Gregor Cantless." Then a few things happened at once. Shai flung the bottle at the doorway and dived for her knife. Cantless dived for her, the other two tangled in the doorway behind him. And Temple dived for the window. Statements about sticking notwithstanding, before he knew it, he was outside, air whooping in his throat in a terrified squeal as he dropped, then rolling in the cold mud, then floundering up and sprinting naked across the main street, which in most towns would have been considered poor form, but in Crease was not especially remarkable. He heard someone bellow and forced himself on, slipping and sliding, and his heart pounding so hard he thought he might have to hold his skull together, the mayor's church of dice lurching closer. When the guards at the door saw him, they smiled, then they frowned, then they caught hold of him as he scrambled up the steps.
"The mayor's got a rule about trousers. Gotta see Lamb. Lamb!"
One of them punched him in the mouth, snapped his head back, and sent him stumbling against the doorframe. He knew he deserved it more than ever, but somehow a fist in the face always came as a surprise.
"Lem!"
he screeched again, covering his head as best he could.
"La— oof!"
The other's fist sank into his gut and doubled him up, drove his wind right out, and dropped him to his knees, blowing bloody bubbles. While he was considering the stones under his face in breathless silence, one of the guards grabbed him by the hair and started dragging him up, raising his fist high.
"Leave him be!"
To Temple's great relief, Savian caught that fist before it came down with one knobbly hand.
"He's with me!"
He grabbed Temple under the armpit with the other and dragged him through the doorway, shrugging off his coat and throwing it around Temple's shoulders.
"What the hell happened?"
"Cantless," croaked Temple, limping into the gaming hall, waving a weak arm towards the hostelry, only able to get enough breath for one wheezing word at a time.
"Shai!"
"What happened?"
Lamb was thumping down the steps from the mayor's room, barefooted himself and with his shirt half-buttoned, and for a moment Temple was wondering why he came that way, and then he saw the drawn sword in Lamb's fist and felt very scared. And then he saw something in Lamb's face that made him feel more scared still.
"Cantless! At Camling's!"
he managed to splutter. Lamb stood a moment, eyes wide, then he strode for the door, brushing the guards out of his way, and Savian strode after.
"Everything all right?" The mayor stood on the balcony outside her rooms in a Gurkish dressing gown, a pale scar showing in the hollow between her collarbones. Temple blinked up, wondering if Lamb had been in there with her, then pulled his borrowed coat around him and hurried after the others without speaking.
"Put some trousers on!" she called after him.
When Temple struggled up the steps of the hostelry, Lamb had Camling by the collar and had dragged him most of the way over his own counter with one hand, sword in the other, and the proprietor desperately squealing,
"They just dragged her out! The White House, maybe. I have no notion. It was none of my doing."
Lamb shoved Camling tottering away and stood, breath growling in his throat. Then he put the sword carefully on the counter and his palms flat before it, fingers spreading out, the wood gleaming in the space where the middle one should have been. Savian walked around behind the counter, shouldering Camling out of the way, took a glass and bottle from a high shelf, blew out one, then pulled the cork from the other.
"You need a hand? You got mine,"
he grunted as he poured. Lamb nodded.
"You should know. Lending me a hand can be bad for your health."
Savian coughed as he nudged the glass across.
"My health's a mess."
What are you going to do? Asked Temple. Have a drink. And Lamb picked up the glass and drained it, white stubble on his throat shifting. Savian tipped the bottle to fill it again.
Lamb!
Lord Ingolstadt walked in somewhat unsteadily, his face pale and his waistcoat covered in stains.
He said you'd be here.
Who said?
Ingolstadt gave a helpless chuckle as he tossed his hat on the counter, a few wisps of stray hair left standing vertically from his head.
Strangest thing, after that fun at Mahood's place, I was playing cards over at Papa Ring's. Entirely lost track of time, and I was somewhat behind, financially, I'll admit, and a gentleman came in to tell Papa something, and he told me he'd forget my debt if I brought you a message.
What message?
Lamb drank again, and Savian filled his glass again. Ingolstadt squinted at the wall.
He said he's playing host to a friend of yours, and he'd very much like to be a gracious host. But you'll have to kiss the mud tomorrow night. He said you'll be dropping anyway, so you might as well drop willingly, and you can both walk out of Crease free people. He said you have his word on that. He was very particular about it. You have his word, apparently.
Well, ain't I the lucky one, said Lamb.
Lord Ingolstadt squinted over at Temple, as though only just noticing his unusual attire.
It appears some people have had an even heavier night than I.
Can you take a message back? Asked Lamb.
I dare say a few more minutes won't make any difference to Lady Ingolstadt's temper at this point. I am doomed, whatever.
Then tell Papa Ring. I'll keep his word safe and sound. And I hope he'll do the same for his guest.
The nobleman yawned as he jammed his hat back on.
Riddles, riddles, they're off to bed for me.
And he strutted back out into the street.
What are you going to do? Whispered Temple.
There was a time I'd have gone charging over there without a thought for the costs and got bloody.
Lamb lifted the glass and looked at it for a moment.
But my father always said, patience is the king of virtues. A man has to be realistic. Has to be.
So, what are you going to do?
Wait. Think. Prepare.
Lamb swallowed the last measure and bared his teeth at the glass.
Then get bloody.
High stakes.
A trim?
Asked Forkin, directing his blank, bland, professional smile towards the mirror.
Or something more radical?
Shave it all off. Hair and beard, close to the skull as you can get.
Forkin nodded, as though that would have been his choice. The client always knows best, after all.
A wet shave of the pate, then?
Wouldn't want to give the other bastard anything to hold on to. And I reckon it's a little late to damage my looks, don't you?
Forkin gave his blank, bland professional chuckle and began, comb struggling with the tangles in Lamb's thick hair, the snipping of the scissors cutting the silence up into neat little fragments. Outside the window, the noise of the swelling crowd grew louder, more excited, and the tension in the room swelled with it. The grey cuttings spilled down the sheet, scattered across the boards in those tantalizing patterns that looked to hold some meaning one could never quite grasp. Lamb stirred at them with his foot.
Where does it all go, eh?
Our time or the hair?
Either one.
In the case of the time, I would ask a philosopher rather than a barber. In the case of the hair, it is swept up and thrown out. Unless, on occasion, one might have a lady friend who would care to be entrusted with a lock.
Lamb glanced over at the mare. She stood at the window, keeping one eye on Lamb's preparations and the other on those in the street, a slender silhouette against the sunset. He dismissed the notion with an explosive snort.
One moment it's a part of you, the next it's rubbish.
We treat whole men like rubbish. Why not the hair?
Lamb sighed. I guess you've got the right of it.
Forkin gave the razor a good slapping on the strap. Clients usually appreciated a flourish, a mirror flash of lamplight on steel, an edge of drama to proceedings.
Careful,
said the mayor, evidently in need of no extra drama today. Forkin had to confess to being considerably more scared of her than he was of Lamb. The Northman he knew for a ruthless killer, but suspected him of harbouring principles of a kind. He had no such suspicions about the mayor. So he gave his blank, bland, professional bow, ceased his sharpening, brushed up a lather, and worked it into Lamb's hair and beard, then began to shave, with patient, careful, hissing strokes.
"Don't it ever bother you that it always grows back?" asked Lamb. "There's no beating it, is there?"
"Could not the same be said of every profession? The merchant sells one thing to buy another. The farmer harvests one set of crops to plant another. The blacksmith—"
"Kill a man, and he stays dead," said Lamb simply.
"But if I might observe, without causing offence, killers rarely stop at one. Once you begin, there is always someone else that needs killing."
Lamb's eyes moved to Forkin's in the mirror.
"You're a philosopher, after all."
"On a strictly amateur footing."
Forkin worked the warm towel with a flourish and presented Lamb shorn, as it were, a truly daunting array of scars laid bare. In all his years as a barber, including 3 in the service of a mercenary company, he had never attended upon a head so battered, dented, and otherwise manhandled.
"Ah."
Lamb leaned closer to the mirror, working his lopsided jaw and wrinkling his bent nose, as though to convince himself it was indeed his own visage gazing back.
"There's the face of an evil bastard, eh?"
"I would venture to say a face is no more evil than a coat. It is the man beneath and his actions that count."
"No doubt."
Lamb looked up at Forkin for a moment, and then back to himself.
"And there's the face of an evil bastard. You done the best a man could with it, though. Ain't your fault what you're given to work with."
"I simply tried to do the job exactly as I'd want it done to me."
"Treat folk the way you'd want to be treated, and you can't go far wrong, my father used to tell me. Seems our jobs are different, after all. Aim of mine is to do the other man exactly what I'd least enjoy."
"Are you ready?"
The mayor had silently drifted closer and was looking at the pair of them in the mirror. Lamb shrugged.
"Either a man's always ready for a thing like this, or he'll never be."
"Good enough."
She came closer and took hold of Forkin's hand. He felt a strong need to back away, but clung to his blank, bland professionalism a moment longer.
"Any other jobs today?"
Forkin swallowed.
"Just the one."
"Across the street?"
He nodded.
The mayor pressed a coin into his palm and leaned close.
"The time is fast approaching when every person in Crease will have to choose one side of the street. I hope you choose wisely."
Sunset had lent the town a carnival atmosphere. There was a single current to the crowds of drunk and greedy, and it flowed to the amphitheatre. As he passed, Forkin could see the circle marked out on the ancient cobbles at its centre, 6 strides across, torches on close-set poles to mark the edge and light the action. The ancient banks of stone seating and the new teetering stands of bodged-together carpentry were already boiling with an audience such as that place had not seen in centuries. Gamblers screeched for business and chalked odds on high boards. Hawkers sold bottles and hot gristle for prices outrageous even in this home of outrageous prices. Forkin gazed at all those people swarming over each other, most of whom could hardly have known what a barber was, let alone thought of employing one, reflected for the 100th time that day
the thousandth time that week, the millionth time since he arrived, that he should never have come here, clung tight to his bag and hurried on. Tupper Ring was one of those men who liked to spend money less the more of it he had. His quarters were humble indeed by comparison with the mayor's, the furniture, an improvised and splinter-filled collection, the low ceiling lumpy as an old bedspread. Glamour Golden sat before a cracked mirror lit by smoking candles, something faintly absurd in that huge body crammed onto a stool and draped in a threadbare sheet, his head giving the impression of teetering on top like a cherry on a cream cake. Ring stood at the window just as the mayor had, his big fists clamped behind his back, and said,
"Shave it all off."
"Except the moustache." Golden gathered up the sheet so he could stroke at his top lip with huge thumb and forefinger.
"Had that all my life, and it's going nowhere."
"A most resplendent article of facial hair," said Forkin, though in truth he could see more than a few grey hairs, despite the poor light. "To remove it would be a deep regret."
In spite of being the undoubted favourite in the coming contest, Golden's eyes had a strange, haunted dampness as they found Forkin's in the mirror.
"You got regrets?"
Forkin lost his blank, bland professional smile for a moment.
"Don't we all, sir?"
He began to cut.
"But I suppose regrets at least prevent one from repeating the same mistakes."
Golden frowned at himself in that cracked mirror.
"I find, however high I stack the regrets, I still make the same mistakes again and again."
Forkin had no answer for that, but the barber holds the advantage in such circumstances. He can let the scissors fill the silence. Snip, snip, and the yellow cuttings scattered across the boards in those tantalizing patterns that looked to hold some meaning one could never quite grasp.
"Been over there with the mayor?"
called Papa Ring from the window.
"Yes, sir, I have."
"How'd she seem?"
Forkin thought about the mayor's demeanor, and more importantly, about what Papa Ring wanted to hear. A good barber never puts truth before the hopes of his clients.
"She seemed very tense."
Ring stared back out of the window, thick thumb and fingers fussing nervously behind his back.
"I guess she would be."
"What about the other man?" asked Golden. "The one I'm fighting."
Forkin stopped snipping for a moment.
"He seemed thoughtful, regretful, but fixed on his purpose. In all honesty, he seemed very much like you."
Forkin did not mention what had only just occurred, that he had, in all likelihood, given one of them their last haircut. B was mopping up when he passed by the door. She hardly even had to see him. She knew him by his footsteps.
"Gregor?"
She dashed out into the hall, heart going so hard it hurt.
"Gregor!"
He turned, wincing, like hearing her say his name made him sick. He looked tired, more than a little drunk, and sore. She could always tell his moods.
"What?"
She'd made up all kinds of little stories about their reunion. One where he swept her into his arms and told her they could get married now. One where he was wounded and she'd to nurse him back to health. One where they argued, one where they laughed, one where he cried and said sorry for how he'd treated her. But she hadn't spun those stories where she was just ignored.
"That all you got to say to me?"
"What else would there be?"
He didn't even look her in the eye.
"I gotta go talk to Papa Ring."
And he made off up the hall. She caught his arm.
"Where are the children?"
Her voice all shrill and bled out from her own disappointment.
"Mind your own business."
"I am. You made me help, didn't you? You made me bring 'em."
"You could have said no."
She knew it was true. she'd been so keen to please him, she'd have jumped in a fire on his say-so. Then he gave a little smile, like he thought of something funny. "But if you must know, I sold 'em." She felt cold to her stomach.
"To who?"
"Those ghosts up in the hills. Those dragon fuckers." Her throat was all closed up. She could hardly talk.
"What'll they do with 'em?"
"I don't know. Fuck 'em. Eat 'em. What do I care? What did you think I was going to do, start up an orphanage?" Her face was burning now, like he'd slapped her. "You're such a stupid sow. Don't know that I ever met anyone stupider than you. You're stupider than—" And she was on him, and tearing at his face with her nails, and she'd probably have bitten him if he hadn't hit her first, just above the eye, and she tumbled into the corner and caught a faceful of floor. "You mad bitch!" She started to push herself up, all groggy, that familiar pulsing in her face, and he was touching his scratched cheek like he couldn't believe it. "What did you do that for?" Then he was shaking out his fingers. "You hurt my fucking hand!" And he took a step towards her as she tried to stand and kicked her in the ribs, folded her gasping around his boot.
"I hate you,"
she managed to whisper once she was done coughing.
"So?"
And he looked at her like she was a maggot. She remembered the day he'd chosen her out of all the room to dance with, and nothing had ever felt so fine, and of a sudden it was like she saw the whole thing fresh, and he seemed so ugly, so petty and vain and selfish beyond enduring. He just used people and threw them away, and left a trail of ruin behind him. How could she ever have loved him? Just because for a few moments he'd made her feel one step above shit, the rest of the time 10 steps below.
"You're so small," she whispered at him. "How did I not see it?"
He was pricked in his vanity then, and he took another step at her, but she found her knife and whipped it out. He saw the blade, and for a moment he looked surprised. Then he looked angry, then he started laughing, like she was a hell of a joke. "As if you've got the bones to use it," and he sauntered past, giving her plenty of time to stab him if she'd wanted to. But she just knelt there, blood leaking out her nose and tapping down the front of her dress, her best dress, which she'd worn 3 days straight, 'cause she knew he'd be coming. Once the dizziness had passed, she got up and went to the kitchen. Everything was trembling, but she'd taken worse beatings, and worse disappointments, too. No one there so much as raised a brow at her bloody nose. The White House was that kind of place.
"Papa Ring said I need to feed that woman."
"Soup in the pot," grunted the cook's boy, perched on a box to look out of a high little window, where all he got was a view of boots outside. So she put a bowl on a tray with a cup of water and carried it down the damp-smelling stair to the cellar, past the big barrels in the darkness and the bottles on the racks gleaming with the torchlight. The woman in the cage uncrossed her legs and stood, sliding her tight-bound hands up the rail behind her, one eye glinting through the hair tangled across her face as she watched Bee come closer. Warp sat in front at his table, ring of keys on it, pretending to read a book. He loved to pretend, thought it made him look right special. But even Bee, who weren't no wonder with her letters, could tell he had it upside down.
"What do you want?"
And he turned a sneer on her like she was a slug in his breakfast.
"Papa Ring said to feed her."
She could almost see his brain rattling around in his big fat head.
"Why? Ain't like she'll be here much longer."
"You think he tells me why?"
she snapped.
"But I'll go back and tell Papa you wouldn't let me in if you—"
"All right. Get it done, then. But I've got my eye on you."
He leaned close and blasted her with his rotting breath.
"Both eyes."
He unlocked the gate and swung it squealing open, and Bee ducked inside with her tray. The woman watched her. She couldn't move far from the rail, but even so she was backed up tight against it. The cage smelled of sweat and piss and fear. The woman's, and all the others who'd been kept in here before, and no bright futures among them, that was a fact. No bright futures anywhere in this place. B set the tray down and took the cup of water. The woman sucked at it thirstily, no pride left in her, if she'd had any to begin with. Pride don't last long in the White House, and especially not down here. B leaned close and whispered,
"You asked me about Cantlis before, about Cantlis and the children."
The woman stopped swallowing, and her eyes flickered over to B's, bright and wild.
"He sold the children to the dragon people. That's what he said."
B looked over her shoulder, but Warp was already sitting back at his table and pulling at his jug, not looking in the least. He wouldn't think B would do anything worth attending to in her whole life. Right now, that worked for her. She stepped closer, slipped out the knife, and sawed through the ropes around one of the woman's rubbed raw wrists.
"Why?"
she whispered.
"Because Cantlis needs hurting."
Even then she couldn't bring herself to say killing, but they both knew what she meant.
"I can't do it."
B pressed the knife, handle first, into the woman's free hand, where it was hidden behind her back.
"Reckon you can, though."
Papa Ring fidgeted at the ring through his ear, an old habit, went right back to his days as a bandit in the Badlands, his nerves rising with the rising noise in a painful lump under his jaw. He'd played a lot of hands, rolled a lot of dice, spun a lot of wheels, and maybe the odds were all stacked on his side, but the stakes had never been higher. He wondered whether she was nervous, the mayor. No sign of it, standing alone on her balcony, bolt upright, with the light behind her, that stiff pride of hers showing even at this distance. But she had to be scared, had to be. How often had they stood there, after all, glaring across the great divide, planning each other's downfall by every means, fair or foul, the number of men they paid to fight for them doubling and doubling again, the stakes swelling ever higher. 100 murders and stratagems and maneuverings and webs of petty alliances broken and reformed, and it all came down to this. He slipped into one of his favorite furrows of thought. What to do with the mare when he won? Hang her as a warning? Have her stripped naked and beaten through town like a hog? Keep her as his whore, as anyone's? But he knew it was all fancy. He'd given his word she'd be let go, and he'd keep it. Maybe folk on the mayor's side of the street took him for a low bastard, and maybe they were right. But all his life, he'd kept his word. It could give you some tough moments, your word. Could force you into places you didn't want to be. Could serve you up puzzles where the right paths weren't easy to pick. But it wasn't meant to be easy. It was meant to be right. There were too many men always did the easy thing regardless. Gregor Cantlis, for instance. Papa Ring looked sourly sideways. Here he was, 3 days late, as always, slumped on Ring's balcony as if he had no bones in him, and picking his teeth with a splinter. In spite of a new suit, he looked sick and old, and had fresh scratches on his face and a stale smell about him. Some men use up fast. But he'd brought what he owed, plus a healthy extra for the favor. That was why he was still breathing. Ring had given his word, after all. The fighters were coming out now, with an accompanying rise in the mood of the mob. Golden's big shaved head bobbed above the crowd, a knot of Ring's men around him clearing folks away as they headed for the theater, old stones lit up orange in the fading light. Ring hadn't mentioned the woman to Golden. He might be a magician with his fists, but that man had a bad habit of getting distracted. So Ring had just told him to let the old man live if he got the chance, and considered that a promise kept. A man's got to keep his word, but there has to be some give in it, or you'll get nothing done. He saw Lamb now, coming down the steps of the mayor's place between the ancient columns, his own entourage of thugs about him. Ring fussed with his ear again. He'd a worry the old Northman was one of those bastards you couldn't trust to do the sensible thing. A right wild card, and Papa Ring liked to know what was in the deck, especially when the stakes were high as this.
"I don't like the looks of that old bastard," Cantlis said.
Papa Ring frowned at him.
"Do you know what? Neither do I."
"You sure Golden'll take him?"
"Golden's taken everyone else, hasn't he?"
"I guess. Got a sad sort of look to him, though, for a winner."
Ring could have done without this fool picking at his worries.
"That's why I had you steal the woman, isn't it? Just in case."
Cantlis rubbed at his stubbly jaw.
"Still seems a hell of a risk."
"One I wouldn't have had to take if you hadn't stole that old bastard's children and sold them to the savage."
Cantlis's head jerked around with surprise.
"I can add two and two," growled Ring, and felt a shiver like he was dirty and couldn't clean it off. "How much lower can a man stoop, selling children?"
Cantlis looked deeply wounded.
"That's so fucking unfair. You just said get the money by winter, or I'd be a dead man. You didn't concern yourself with the source. You want to give me the money back, free yourself of its base origins?"
Ring looked at the old box on the table and thought about that bright old gold inside and frowned back out into the street. He hadn't got where he'd got by giving money back.
"Didn't think so."
Cantlis shook his head, like stealing children was a fine business scheme for which he deserved the warmest congratulation.
"How was I to know this old bastard would wriggle out the long grass?"
"Because," said Ring, speaking very slow and cold, "you should have learned by now there's consequences when you fucking do a thing, and a man can't wander through life thinking no further ahead than the end of his cock."
Cantlis worked his jaw and muttered, "So fucking unfair." And Ring was forced to wonder when was the last time he'd punched a man in the face. He was sorely, sorely tempted. But he knew it would solve nothing. That's why he stopped doing it and started paying other people to do it for him.
"Are you a child yourself to whine about what's fair?" he asked. "You think it's fair I have to stand up for a man, can't tell a good hand of cards from a bad, but still has to bet an almighty pile of money he don't have on the outcome? You think it's fair I have to threaten some girl's life to make sure of a fight? How does that reflect on me, eh? How's that for the start of my new era? You think it's fair I got to keep my word to men don't care a damn about theirs, eh? What's God-fucked fair about all that? Go and get the woman."
"Me?
Your bloody mess I'm aiming to clean up, isn't it? Bring her up here so our friend Lamb can see Papa Ring's a man of his word."
"I might miss the start," said Cantlis, like he couldn't believe he'd been inconvenienced to such an extent by a pair of very likely deaths.
"You keep talking, you'll be missing the rest of your fucking life, boy. Get the woman."
Cantlis stomped for the door, and Ring thought he heard him mutter, "Ain't fair." He gritted his teeth as he turned back towards the theatre. That bastard made trouble everywhere he went, and had a bad end coming, and Ring was starting to hope it had come sooner rather than later. He straightened his cuffs and consoled himself with the thought that once the mayor was beaten, the bottom would fall right out of the henchman market, and he could afford to hire himself a better class of thug. The crowd was falling silent now, and Ring reached for his ear, then stopped himself, stifling another swell of nerves. He'd made sure the odds were all stacked on his side, but the stakes had never been higher.
"Welcome all!" bellowed Camling, greatly relishing the way his voice echoed to the very heavens. "To this, the historic theatre of Crease. In the many centuries since its construction, it can rarely have seen so momentous an event as that which will shortly be played out before your fortunate eyes.
Could eyes be fortunate independently of their owners? This question gave Camling an instant's pause before he dismissed it. He could not allow himself to be distracted. This was his moment. The torchlit bowl crammed with onlookers, the street beyond heaving with those on tiptoe for a look, the trees on the valley side above even carrying cargoes of intrepid observers in their upper branches, all hanging upon his every word. Noted hotelier he might have been, but he was without doubt a sad loss to the performing arts.
"A fight, my friends and neighbors, and what a fight! A contest of strength and guile between two worthy champions to be humbly refereed by myself, Leonard Camling, as a respected neutral party and long-established leading citizen of this community."
He thought he heard someone call,
"Corklane,"
but ignored it.
"A contest to settle a dispute between two parties over a claim according to mining law."
"Get the fuck on with it,"
someone shouted. There was a scattering of laughs, boos, and jeers. Camling gave a long pause, chin raised, and treated the savages to a lesson in cultured gravity. The type of lesson he had been hoping Josef Lessek might administer. What a farce that had turned out to be.
"Standing for Papa Ring, a man who needs no introduction."
"Why, give him one then."
More laughter.
"Who has forged a dread name for himself across the fighting pits, cages, and circles of the near and far countries ever since he left his native north. A man undefeated in 22 encounters. Glamour Golden!"
Golden shouldered his way into the circle, stripped to the waist, his huge body smeared with grease to frustrate an opponent's grasp, great slabs of muscle glistening white by torchlight, and reminding Camling of the giant albino slugs he sometimes saw in his cellar and was irrationally afraid of. With his skull shaved, the Northman's luxuriant moustache looked even more of an absurd affectation, but the volume of the crowd's bellows only increased. A breathless frenzy had descended upon them, and they no doubt would have cheered an albino slug if they had thought it might bleed for their entertainment.
"And standing for the mayor, his opponent, Lamb!"
Much less enthusiastic cheering as the second fighter stepped into the circle to a last frantic round of betting. He was likewise shaved and greased, his body so covered with a multitude of scars that, even if he had no fame as a fighter, his familiarity with violence was not to be doubted. Camling leaned close to whisper,
"Just that for a name?"
"Good as another," said the old Northman, without removing his steady gaze from his opponent. No doubt everyone considered him the underdog. Certainly Camling had almost discounted him until that very moment. The older, smaller, leaner man, the gambler's odds considerably against him, but Camling noticed something in his eye that gave him pause. An eager look, as though he had an awful hunger, and Golden was the meal. The bigger man's face, by contrast, held a trace of doubt as Camling ushered the two together in the center of the circle.
"Do I know you?" he called over the baying of the audience. "What's your real name?"
Lamb stretched his neck out to one side and then the other.
"Maybe it'll come to you."
Camling held one hand high.
"May the best man win!"
he shrieked. Over the sudden roar, he heard Lamb say,
"It's the worst man wins these."
This would be Golden's last fight, that much he knew. They circled each other, footwork, footwork, step and shuffle, each feeling out the other, the wild noise of the crowd and their shaken fists and twisted faces pushed off to one side. No doubt they were eager for the fight to start. They didn't realize that oftentimes the fight was won and lost here, in the slow movements before the fighters even touched. By the dead, though, Golden was tired, failures and regrets dragging after him like chains on a swimmer, heavier with each day, with each breath. This had to be his last fight. He'd heard the Far Country was a place where men could find their dreams and come searching for a way to claim back all he'd lost, but this was all he'd found. Glamour Golden, mighty war chief, hero of Ollansand, who'd stood tall in the songs and on the battlefield, admired and feared in equal measure, rolling in the mud for the amusement of morons. A tilt of the waist and a dip of the shoulder, a couple of lazy ranging swings, getting the other man's measure. He moved well, this lamb, whatever his age. He was no stranger to this business. There was a snap and steadiness to his movements, and he wasted no effort. Golden wondered what his failures had been, what his regrets. What dream had he come chasing after into this circle? "Leave him alive, if you can," Ring had said, which only showed how little he understood, in spite of his endless bragging about his word. There were no choices in a fight like this, life and death on the leveler's scales. There was no place for mercy, no place for doubts. He could see in Lamb's eyes that he knew it too. Once two men step into the circle, nothing beyond its edge can matter, past or future. Things fall the way they fall. Golden had seen enough. He squeezed his teeth together and rushed across the circle. The old man dodged well, but Golden still caught him by the ear and followed with a heavy left in the ribs, felt the thud right up his arm, warming every joint. Lamb struck back, but Golden brushed it off, and as quickly as they'd come together, they were apart, circling again, watching, a gust swirling around the theater and dragging out the torch flames. He could take a punch, this old man, still moving calm and steady, showing no pain. Golden might have to break him down piece by piece, use his reach, but that was well enough. He was warming to the task. His breath came faster, and he growled along with it, his face finding a fighting snarl, sucking in strength and pushing out doubt, all his shame and disappointment made tinder for his anger. Golden slapped his palms together hard, feinted right, then hissed as he darted in, faster and sharper than before, catching the old man with two more long punches, bloodying his bent nose, staggering him and dancing away before he could think of throwing back, the stone bowl ringing with encouragements and insults and fresh odds in a dozen languages. Golden settled to the work. He had the reach and the weight and the youth, but he took nothing for granted. He would be cautious. He would make sure. This would be his last fight, after all.
"I'm coming, you bastard! I'm coming!"
shouted Payne, hobbling down the hall on his iffy leg. Bottom of the pile, that's what he was. But he guessed every pile needs someone on the bottom, and probably he didn't deserve to be no higher. The door was jolting in its frame from the blows outside. They should have had a slot to look through. He'd said that before, but no one took no notice. Probably they couldn't hear him through that heap of folks on top. So he had to wrestle the bolt back and haul the door open a bit to see who was calling. There was an old drunk outside, tall and bony, with grey hair plastered to one side of his head and big hands flapping, and a tattered coat with what looked like old vomit down one side and fresh down the other.
"I want to get fucked,"
he said in a voice like rotten wood splitting.
"Don't let me stop you,"
and Payne swung the door shut. The old man wedged a boot in it, and the door bounced back open.
"I want to get fucked," I says. "We're closed."
"You what?"
The old man craned close, most likely deaf as well as drunk. Payne heaved the door open wider so he could shout it.
"There's a fight on, case you didn't notice. We're closed."
"I did notice, and I don't care a shit. I want fucking, and I want it now. I got dust, and I heard tell the White House is never closed to business. Not never."
"Shit,"
hissed Payne. That was true. Never closed, Papa Ring was always telling them. But then they'd been told to be careful, and triple careful today.
"Be triple careful today,"
Papa had told them all.
"I can't stand a man ain't careful,"
which had sounded strange, since no one round here was ever the least bit careful.
"I want a fuck,"
grunted the old man, hardly able to stand up straight, he was that drunk. Payne pitied the girl got that job. He stank like all the shit in Greece. Usually there'd be three guards at the door, but the others had all snuck off to watch the fight and left him on his own, bottom of the bloody heap that he was. He gave a strangled groan of upset, turned to shriek for someone just a little higher up the heap, and to his great and far from pleasant surprise, an arm slipped tight around his neck and a cold point pressed into his throat, and he heard the door swing shut behind.
"Where's the woman you took?"
The old man's breath stank like a still, but his hands were tight as vices.
"Shy South, skinny thing with a big mouth. Where is she?"
"I don't know nothing about no woman,"
Payne managed to splutter, trying to say it loud enough to get someone's attention, but half swallowing his words from the pressure.
"Guess I might as well open you up then,"
and Payne felt the point of the knife dig into his jaw.
"Fuck! All right, she's in the cellar!"
"Lead on."
And the old man started moving him. One step, two, and suddenly it just got to Payne what a damn indignity this was on top of everything else, and without thinking, he started twisting and thrashing and elbowing away, struggling like this was his moment to get out from under the bottom of that heap and finally be somebody worthy of at least his own respect. But the old man was made of iron. That knotty hand clamped Payne's windpipe shut so he couldn't make more than a gurgle, and he felt the knife's point burning across his face right up under his eye.
"Struggle any more, and that eye's coming out."
And there was a terrible coldness in the old man's voice, froze all the fight right out.
"You're just the fool who opens the door, so I reckon you don't owe Papa Ring too much. He's finished anyway. Take me to the woman and do nothing stupid. You'll live to be the fool who opens someone else's door. Make sense?"
The hand released enough for him to choke.
"Make sense?"
It did make sense, too. That was about as much fight as Payne had showed in his whole life, and where'd it got him? He was just the fool who opened the door. Bottom of the pile. Golden had bloodied the old man's face up something fierce. Drizzle was streaking through the light about the torches, cool on his forehead, but he was hot inside now, doubts banished. He had Lamb's measure, and even the blood in his mouth tasted like victory. This would be his last fight, back to the north with Ring's money, and win back his lost honour and his lost children, cut his revenge out of Cairm Ironhead and Black Calder. The thought of those hated names and faces bringing up the fury in a sudden blaze. Golden roared, and the crowd roared with him, carried him across the circle as if on the crest of a wave. The old man pushed away one punch and slipped under another, found a hold on Golden's arm, and they slapped and twisted, fingers wriggling for a grip, hands slippery with grease and drizzle, feet shuffling for advantage. Golden strained and heaved, and finally, with a bellow, got Lamb off his feet. But the old man hooked his leg as he went down, and they crashed together onto the stones, the crowd leaping up in joy as they fell. Golden was on top. He tried to get a hand around the old man's throat, fumbled with a notch out of his ear, tried to rip at it, but it was too slippery, tried to inch his hand up onto Lamb's face so he could get his thumbnail in his eye, the way he had with that big miner back in the spring, and of a sudden his head was dragged down, and there was a burning, tugging pain in his mouth. He bellowed and twisted and growled, clawed at Lamb's wrist with his nails, and, with a stinging and ripping right through his lip and into his gums, he tore himself free and thrashed away. As Lamb rolled up, he saw the old man had yellow hairs caught in one fist, and Golden realized he'd torn half his moustache out. There was laughter in the crowd, but all he heard was the laughter years behind him as he trudged from Scarling's hall and into exile.
The rage came up white-hot, and Golden charged in, shrieking. No thoughts, except the need to smash Lam apart with his fists. He caught the old man square in the face,